my God, you mean I can get a degree in talking about shit that I talk about with my friends at the beach when I'm getting high? Yeah, I'll get a degree in that.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome. I got a good one. I got a crazy one here. I've got a very interesting woman here who's done an awful lot. She's got a very, very interesting background, varied. Grew up in Chicago. We'll find out about that. Lives in California, out on the beautiful coast of Zuma, Malibu area, I think. Find out about that because I know that area pretty well. L. Russ, that's who I have today. This is a fascinating woman. I just love doing the research on her and getting her background. This lady, she has done everything here, and she's an expert in the paleo scene. She's an expert in the thyroid scene. We're going to find out about that. She had an issue with that, self-diagnosed, and we'll find out how that went. But this lady is amazing. She's a writer, an actor, a host of the Primal Blueprint podcast. And by the way, if you haven't heard of it, you should. It's ranked 20th on iTunes in health. And here's what I love. I stumbled on this, and I can't wait. We're going to find out all about this, too, before we get into her business today here. But alumna of the Second City Chicago version, which all of you should know is a world-famous comedy theater. I have profound respect for improv people, and we're talking to one. And we're gonna put her on the spot here and get some improv out of here. But this is a very famous place. This is not a place for lightweights. The people who come out of Second City are quick, fast, they can think, they can move, and man, I have nothing but the highest of respect for people who do that, and she's done a lot more than that. She's also written and performed over 1,000 live sketch comedy shows. What a surprise, because this is sort of where she comes from and her background, and I'm going to really want to understand how we migrated from comedy into paleo and thyroid stuff. She's also written and performed in over 1,000, well, I mentioned that. She writes sitcoms, books, documentaries, dramas, and more. And one of the things I stumbled upon, too, also, which blew my mind, and I want to get into this one right away. I want to get right to you, Elle, here on this. You wrote the script for award-winning documentary called Headhunt Revisited.
Yep.
Now, I have the notes on that, but I'm not going to touch my notes. I just want to go right into this interview with – I'm going to back up to some of these things I mentioned, but I want to know what this Headhunt Revisited thing was all about. What is that? And by the way, welcome to the Who Are You podcast. So glad to have
you.
Hey,
everyone. Hey, thanks for that intro. I mean, I'm like going to write you a check. There's an old recycled joke from forever. Also, it's over 100 sketch comedy and improv live shows, not 1,000. So I just want to, although that would be very impressive.
Yeah, exaggeration to make a point.
But yeah, tons of them. So yeah, Headhunt Revisited. What is that about? Is that what you want to get into?
I mean, I know a little bit of it. I mean, it's so off the beaten path here that, as I say, before we get into paleo and thyroid and Second City, what is that? Yeah, what is that?
Yeah, well, you know, oddly enough, it kind of, before I got into the paleo world, I was already starting this documentary because, as you know, documentaries, they usually do take a while depending on the subject matter, just because gathering footage and, you know, the time it takes to get all the people together to kind of help out for free, because that's how it works on documentaries. And so, you know, this took about 7 years for the producer of this documentary to fully complete and, you know, submit it, right? So before I even knew about paleo, I had been involved in this. And then when I got involved in paleo, I was like, well, it's kind of interesting that I'm, you know, doing kind of a primitive documentary, and just kind of like works out. So this is a really interesting, fascinating story that I am so proud to have written and be a part of and tell, because not only is it just a story about two badass females, and let me just give you the rundown. There was a woman named Carolyn Meidinger back in the 20s who was a Midwesterner, and she was married, and she was a portrait painter, painted other people's, you know, faces, and she wanted to be an artist in her own right. You know, and she just was this free spirit. And her husband at the time, so progressive, literally wrote her a letter, which we have, that basically was like, hey, I release you into the world, you know, go follow your dream. And she, her desire was to go to Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, Melanesia, and paint the indigenous peoples before they became extinct. And she was like, I've got to get over there. Now, no one in the 20s was just jumping into Melanesia. There were headhunters there. You know what I mean? And the reputation.
Yeah,
right. And that reputation also was cannibalism, right? You know, all that stuff, all that dark, you know, mysterious stuff comes from those islands, really. So, you know, she traveled. She went off with a friend. That's not what the movie's about, but it's a little suspect. And her buddy Margaret, and they traveled for 4 years through Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, and she wrote two books about her journeys, and she had over, 40 sketches, so many paintings. They are really beautiful. I'm very picky about art in general, and I love art, but I'm kind of picky about it. So if I had hated the art in this film, I would have never even agreed to write. So she went and they painted and, suffered malaria and, they painted their way through the islands. They didn't have any money and they would just paint portraits of the plantation owners along the way. And they were really this integral part of history in that region and discovered and were some of the first Americans to make it to the mouth of the Fly River, this famous place where other discoverers, had not even gone. So she was this pioneer, such a badass woman. And so then what happened is 60 plus years later, this underwater photographer that I know named Michelle Westmoreland, she had been diving a lot in Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands and caught wind of this woman and her work and her books and contacted the family who's up in Northern California. All of the art preserved, went and looked at it, and it's just incredible. And then what she did is she literally spent her life savings and took off and retraced Carolyn's steps through her books all the way through the Solomon Islands, got a crew on a boat, and they went through and retraced all of her steps and met people in the paintings, like descendants of some of the subjects of the paintings. And so there's a lot of, some of the paintings of hers are the only historical record of some of those people at all. And so it's just this really interesting one. It's called Headhunt Revisited Through Brush, Canvas, and Camera. And it's really this journey, it's Carolyn's journey, this wonderful, brave woman's journey to go and do this. But it's also really shining a light on the culture and the people of Melanesia. Not many people really are even familiar or know where Melanesia was even a word. Some people don't even know what Oceania is, and that's really where Palau and Micronesia is. And again, these are places where I just challenge the audience to go look up on the map. They are some of the most beautiful places in the world as well. And not many people know about their culture. They really haven't been exposed. So it's just a beautiful journey. And Lauren Hutton is the voice of Carolyn. And, if anyone out there knows Lauren Hutton, she's just It turns out that when the director went to Lauren Hutton to say, hey, went to her office and said, here's the pitch. I would love you to be the voice. I just feel like you are so this woman. And Lauren Hutton pointed to her bookshelf. She had Carolyn's books on her shelf.
Wild.
Because Lauren Hutton happens to be a very proficient and high-level scuba diver.
Well, let me ask you, Lauren Hutton go into the headhunter tribes?
She's not in the documentary, like, traipsing through the forest or anything. That would be awesome. But her voice is wonderful. So it's a combination of past and present, some current artists there, shedding light on the culture, the history, and really dispelling some of these fears and rumors. People still to this day, might go, a bunch of cannibals or, And so it's just it's a really beautiful film. I'm so proud of it. It will probably be out on some channel of some kind, iTunes, Netflix, et cetera, within hopefully 2019. But I'm so proud of it. It really came together well and won an award at La Femme Film Festival in Los Angeles. And so, yeah, just really excited about that. And, just on a note that has nothing to do with film, this has to do with something where, like, when I was pitched this as a writer, okay, so just as a writer, someone's like, hey, I need a writer. I've had this idea for this documentary. Okay. My thought was, well, I've never written a documentary. So yeah, let's do that. Right. Let's put that feather in the cap. Let's do that. Now, some people will be like, ooh, but I've never written a documentary before. You know what? If you're a writer, you're a writer. You figure it out. Okay.
It's really true. If you're a CEO, you're a CEO and you figure it out.
That's right. So you go figure it out. And so I did. And let me just tell you something. One of the things that's really funny about, well, first of all, produced and directed by a woman, edited by a woman, written by a woman. Kick ass, And
so I'm hearing serious, quote an oft used phrase today. I'm hearing serious.
Yeah. And it's funny because when it was finalized, which was like this year, and then the Me Too and all the women's stuff just blew up, and we're like, okay, well, I guess the timing was meant to happen for that one. No, but it's really empowering.
Good timing.
Yeah, really empowering film, really beautiful visually. There's animation. The music is incredible. And, anyone can just go to headhuntrevisited.com and find out more about the film. And yeah, so there's that.
Yeah, well, that's so. There's that. That's more than just that. I'm going to see it because my research ended something like, her visit to the headhunter tribes in 1927 in the Southwest Pacific, and they managed to come back alive. And I thought, well,
right.
I'm going to see this because any story that any research I do, any of my forensics comes up with a line like that. I got to see what the story was about and what it is they faced that ends with something like, hey, they came back alive to be able to tell this story on canvas. And so that's Headhunt Revisited with brush, canvas, and camera. And I'm going to be looking for it, and I think everyone ought to be looking for it. So congratulations on that.
Thanks. So much fun.
Hey, it sounds like a blast here. Okay, your time is limited today, so I'm going to push through this like I normally don't because you're such an interesting person. I'm just going to try to hit on a lot of stuff and get in what we can get here. All right, Second City. For God's sakes.
Dream come true.
Take me all the way back. Take me back and tell me all about it because that's huge. That's like the Olympics of comedy.
You know, it really is. And it's so nice when people kind of know that who know it because people who don't know the Second City don't realize how important it is.
Huge.
To have that on your resume.
Look, I'm not kidding everybody when I say it's like the Olympics of comedy. This is a you tell the story. Fire away.
So you know, growing up, I was a camper at all girls camp, and then there was like an all boys camp 10 miles down the road that had kind of been around the same. And you know, we do things together, right? The summer, the kids would get together, and one of the camp counselors was Chris Farley at the boys camp, and they would do these like counselor stunt nights, which were
You worked with Farley?
No, I didn't work with him, but I was a camper when he was like a. See, he's older than me, or he's dead, but he's older than me. So when I was like a camper, he might have been like 18 or something, 19, working as a cookie at the boys camp kind of thing, you know?
Because
you know, once you're a camper, you've been in something like that for a long time, you come back and you're usually a counselor. And so it's sort of a traditional kind of place. It's called Red Arrow Camp, still in existence. And so they would do counselor stunt nights, and it was like watching Saturday Night Live. And I loved that as a kid. I was obsessed with David Letterman as a kid. I went to Second City shows. I grew up in downtown Chicago, so I went to Second City shows as a kid, and I always wanted to do it. But you know, and again, this is a lesson for everyone, you know, jump on it sooner, because growing up, you just think that's not realistic. You know, you just go, no, I'm going to go be a lawyer because that sounds like that's just not a quote real job. And you kind of hear that in the ether. You know, not necessarily directly from my parents or anything, but just, you know, it's kind of like the vibe. So I never thought about doing it seriously, but it always nagged at me because, you know, I would go to college and like I was friends with everyone in the theater department, even though I wasn't, and they were all doing comedy stuff. And I was like, I just love this so much. So I was like, oh man. So, then I had the opportunity to sort of, this is a whole other story, but I had an opportunity to semi-retire at the age of 23, where not retire, that sounds really gratuitous. I was in a financial situation where I was able to really just go and kind of do what I wanted.
That's what everyone's trying to do.
And so I immediately was like I was in the corporate world and, in San Francisco. And the first thought was I'm going back to Chicago to do the Second City. Like there's no question about it. I'm going right in there. So I went to the Second City, went through some of the classes. When I'm in the classes, a couple guys approached me. Classic, by the way, when you're a chick in comedy, because there's always somebody that's like, hey, we need a girl for the, you know, need that chick for the sketch. So they were like, hey, we want to do this show. We want to pitch it to Second City to do it here. And, you know, we think you're great. So I got together with this group and these guys are still out and they're out in LA too. And they're acting and you see them a lot. And so we put up our show and it was like my first sketch comedy show. And then after that, I came out to LA. I did Second City in LA, but it wasn't the level that it is in Chicago at all. So then I went to Acme Comedy Theater in Los Angeles, which had been around for 25 years and no longer has the main stage like we used to. But then we did main stage shows like Saturday Night Live, and we had celebrity guests on Saturday nights. And that's where I really found my home and did a ton of improv and sketch comedy shows for many, many years, and found writing partners, you know, to write sitcoms and all that kind of stuff with, and still talk to all my comedy buddies. It's like a family, you know, you go through that stuff with people for years and years. It's just, you know, here's the thing. It's just so much fun. So yes, I own mustaches and wigs, and it's like, you know, it's like one of those weird things. So I rarely, like when I'm doing sketch comedy, unless I'm playing the reactor, I rarely look like me. I'm kind of a character person with dialects and accents and, you know, affectations. So oftentimes I don't, like, there's been sketches where I've gone back out after the show into the, you know, theater waiting area, and my best friends did not know that that was me. So they would be like, that sketch was great. And I was like, that was, yeah, thanks. They're like, oh my God, that was you? Like, that for real. So I, that's kind of was my thing. That was my known thing, to kind of do characters.
You were a version, you were a version of Houdini doing stuff, but not letting people know who you were.
A little bit. But it was so much fun. It was so fun to play character. It was so fun to do it. And seriously, it really was a dream come true satisfied. I'd always wanted to be a main stage member of a comedy theater like a Second City. And I was. And I still to this day, it's been years since I've done sketch comedy on stage. And I am laughing going to sleep thinking about a sketch someone pitched that never made it into a show, but it's still cracking me up to this day. There is no end to the joy of face hurting from this. It's as good and as fun as you think it is. When you watch SNL and you're like, oh man, that must be it is the best, except they get paid for it. We did it for free, but that's not the point. It's amazing. If anyone wants to do it, you got to do it. Now, one of the things about it that's really extra great for business and life is the level of no shame and fearlessness you have to have in order.
I got to hyperemphasize what you said. The no shame and fearlessness you have to do what you do is crazy, crazy.
And it contributes to every part of life. So if anyone's shy or any kind of issues with that, or fear of performance, or you want to be a public speaker, even, I actually think taking any kind of improv class, preferably at a good place, is great, because you know what? It's embarrassing. It's gross. It's yucky. It's embarrassing. It's gross. It's embarrassing and weird, and it's super weird. And you know, I haven't done improv for a few years, and I bet if I jumped into a group of even my best comedy buddies and we were doing improv, I would probably be like, guys, I'm feeling gross. I'm feeling weird right now. It's been a while. Because it is. It's a really a level of putting yourself.
And you're
out
a bizarre
there.
Crowd. Let's face it. Comedians are strange people. They are. You guys.
I don't know. I think you're right. I mean, we have, you know, it's great because one thing about comedy buddies, usually I haven't come across the opposite yet, is that you never have to edit yourself.
You can't. You can't edit yourself. You have to be that. You have to be just that. Insane. I think comedies.
The sketch comedy stuff. So I love it. And I still jump into it every now and then. I have friends who'd be like, hey, I want to be in a sketch. I'm in a film. And, you know, I'll do it. I still love it. And if someone said, hey, you want to do a reunion show or you want to do another show, I would jump in on it.
Right. Well, look, we could talk about this all day, and we probably should have another discussion for the comedians in our audience and the people who need to come out of their shells. You could teach them how to do that by taking an improv class. But let's jump into, how did it happen that you became one of the preeminent people in the paleo space, particularly the thyroid solution space? And we're going to talk about the book, Paleo Thyroid Solution. And I think you're also one of the only people that offer a lifestyle and weight loss program plan specifically targeted for the thyroid hormone issue. What's that all about? How'd you get into it? Walk us into that story.
Total accident. And, but not really though. Cause again, you know, it's interesting. Like, I never figured I'd write a documentary. Someone approached me with one. I never thought I'd write a book and then got an opportunity. So it kind of linked up with my writing passions, but I didn't see that at first. I was just looking for a job 6 years ago of some kind that was sort of would work with my schedule and allow me to still audition and do what I needed to do. And I got a job with Mark Sisson in Malibu, and I didn't know who he was. He had just written The Primal Blueprint and had a blog, but he didn't have the huge multimillion-dollar Mayo company and Primal Kitchen company that he has now. He didn't have the podcast that I host. I co-host with him, although I do more of them than he does. And so I just met him, and I was like, oh, a guy that wrote this health book, whatever. And if you don't know who Mark Sisson is, just Google Mark and Carrie Sisson. Sisson, and you'll be blown away by the way that they look. And so was I. So Mark's turning 65 this year, his wife 62. I'm working for them and I'm looking at them and I'm going, these guys are 20 plus years older than me and they look so much freaking better than me, man. Like, this is not right. You know, and they were not like working out all the time, you know, and I know they have a background in health and personal training. So that would make sense that they're sort of fit, but kind of defying age. And so I was like, you know what? I really need to like reread his book. I need to look more into what he's saying because I kind of glossed over it when I first worked for him. And so then I saw a talk that he did and I totally understood it. I tried it. So many things happened with my body, my life. With regards to thyroid as well, I cut my thyroid medication in half. All of these things started to go away. I just couldn't believe the changes, and I can get into that in a minute. But so I went to Mark and the light bulb went off at that point. So before that, I had already been helping people with thyroid, not in a professional way, but more of a, I would just run into them everywhere all over the world. And my friends would be like, you should write a book because you keep running into these people. And I would be like, yeah, whatever, someday I will. Because, you know, when you're a creative writer and you're a comedy-driven person, you know, it's like, I don't want to write a health book, right? Like, whatever, that's the last on the list, you know what I mean? But then when I became paleo and saw how everything was connected, the light bulbs all went off because I'm the first person to connect all of these things together with a thyroid, at least in a book. Perhaps someone had the idea before. And it just, I was compelled to write it. It's like you're compelled. It's almost like when I heard the story of Carolyn and heard about these badass chicks and saw the art, I was like, oh, I want to be a part of this. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And so it was almost the same thing where, so then it became not a like, all right, well, I'll write a documentary just to like knock one out. It was like, oh, this is going to be cool. And the same thing happened here. Where I was like, oh my God, now I really need to write a book because I just discovered discovered it. So I went to Mark and I said, hey, like, here's the thing. And he's like, you know, it's funny because I've been wanting to like publish a thyroid book. And I said, well, you know, and then he made me work for it.
He made you work for it and it worked out pretty well. By the way, yeah. Mark is a heavyweight in the space. And if you don't know, most of the audience here does know him. But if you don't, check him out. He's a heavyweight. He knows what he's doing. Very big into the health, fitness, paleo scene. But this book that you wrote is an Amazon bestseller.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it's, you know, honestly, considering the tininess of Primal Blueprint Publishing, our company, and considering that really all of the marketing was done by, you know, Mark's company and me alone as a person, again, another reason to get out of one shell, right?
Absolutely.
No one's going to come to your door. But I also just knew that the message was the message. Because here's the thing, the reason I didn't write a thyroid book many years ago before I discovered this and people would go, oh, you should write it, is because I had read every thyroid book out there. At the time, I didn't have anything to say more than what they were already saying. There wasn't any new, do you know what I mean? It didn't.
Yeah. There is nothing new under the sun.
There's nothing, and it, to some degree, it's not that everything in my book is new, right? But, you know, said in a way that, presented in a way I think that's more palatable. Also, I thought all the other thyroid books, except for two others other than mine, because there are two other books that I really love other than mine and recommend, but all the others I just think are a waste of time. And I remember being like, I'm not going to write a book unless I can really, but you know, going through two bouts of hypothyroidism and having to literally solve it myself and be my own doctor, it gives a whole new breadth of understanding to the science behind it. And so that combined with ancestral principles, again, like that light bulb went off and I was compelled. It was not like, oh, I can write this, so I will. It was like, no, I need to tell people about this.
So what is it? What is hypothyroidism? What is it? How does it affect people? What does it do? What is it? Walk us through what the issue is.
So the thyroid is a gland and it's the master gland of everybody's human body. Okay. You'll die without it. About one in a gajillion people are born without it. And if you're born without one, they would administer thyroid hormones right away because you die. So if your thyroid gland is missing because it was removed or something from thyroid cancer, you would have to go on thyroid hormone replacement or you literally can't live. So that sounds pretty severe, and it is. And here's why. So the reason it's the master gland is that thyroid hormones are responsible for your metabolic rate. So if you're interested in fat burning at all, then you should be interested. It's also heart rate, temperature, all of the metabolic processes that go on, thinking, thought. So you want, it's a Goldilocks situation. You don't want an outpouring of thyroid hormones and you don't want low. And hypothyroidism is an epidemic, and that's underactive thyroid hormone or low thyroid hormone, however it occurred. And usually in that case, because it's the master gland and responsible for temperature and fat burning, you become very fat, you become very freezing, your hair falls out, you start to have accelerated glycation, you're aging at a very fast pace. It's a total effing disaster. You can't think, you're depressed because there's more thyroid receptors in the brain than anywhere else. So it's this thing. And what it is the problem with it is that too many of the doctors are uninformed.
And you were misdiagnosed.
I was misdiagnosed with stuff I didn't have, really. And again, this is like if anyone's misdiagnosed or anyone's diagnosed with bipolar disease, polycystic ovarian syndrome, infertility, depression, anything, basically anything, you check the thyroid first. Because if that's off, it'll affect hormones. It is the producer and regulator of all of the production of the sex hormones.
Well, that's reason enough right there to get on top of it.
It is, because so everyone who's trying to have a baby should go get their thyroid figured out and make sure that is good to go, because you don't need unnecessary miscarriages. Also, you don't need to suffer through years of infertility either with guys. You know what I mean? It's usually in the way of low testosterone and exhaustion. So they'll have the same symptoms. They could be gaining weight, cold, but sometimes with guys, it's really the low testosterone thing and lack of recovery and total exhaustion and brain fog. And it might be not waking up with erections at the appropriate age. Okay, like if you're 90 and you're listening to this, like maybe you can give up on that. You know, like, keep it up, buddy. But no, I mean, but if you're – but unless you're 90, okay, like you know what I mean, then this should be a regular thing, or disruption of sleep. So that would be more of the guys. They would have that issue kind of show up right away. For women, it can be seen gynecologically and elsewhere. So anyway, there's a slew of symptoms that you get, and it's totally debilitating because you go to doctor after doctor and they're taking the wrong tests. They're taking 30, 40 year old tests. It's old paradigm business is what it is. It's just, and those people usually don't take insurance and get dictated by insurance companies. So likely your HMO doctor is not going to know what they're talking about. And your endocrinologist is going to be too ego ridden and also steeped in old, protocols to not be open. And so the best people to try to find to deal with thyroid problems are functional medicine doctors, like MDs who went above and beyond, got into functional medicine, are going to spend an hour with you, you know, or a functional MD and a true integrative MD, because these people have gone above and beyond. They are like way ahead of the game in terms of what they know. And so a lot of 60% of people are undiagnosed. 200 million people have it in the world. It's the number one prescription in America. 23 plus million Americans have it. And again, there's a lot of undiagnosed people out there. But it's not just that you get diagnosed and then you get treated. Then there's that problem, because the treatment is outdated too. So it's like you've got double uninformed shiz happening over here, and it takes years for people to figure it out, and it shouldn't. This is like a no-brainer kind of. It takes a little bit of time, but really, if you know what you're doing, you can solve this problem within 6 months, definitely within a year. And sometimes three, if you catch it right away, just a couple months, boom, you know, and you do what you need to do. So it's just unfortunate because people suffer. They spend all this money on doctors and supplements and biohacking, and they've been led down this road. And, you know, I got to tell you, I had to do like some real serious coaching around doctors for a while because, you know, I've met great doctors since. It's been an amazing blessing to be in this space and meet really awesome doctors that know what's up, especially Dr. Forsman, the doctor on my book. But it's hard when you realize and look back. This didn't happen to me, but it's happened to other people, that you didn't need that hysterectomy. It's a real effed up moment when you look and realize you didn't need to have something removed. You didn't need to have your thyroid gland removed, or you look back and you realize you spent 30 years on the wrong thyroid hormone replacement. 30 years.
How do they get it so wrong? How can they be so off the beaten track? How can they mess up this bad?
And that was my question to Dr. Forrest. I'm like, how is it that they don't know? And here's the thing. It really comes down to, unfortunately, I hate to say it, it does come down to ego. Dr. Forsman's opinion in my book in the Q&A was, look, here's the deal. Think about it. You're an endocrinologist. You spent all this money, all this time. How could I have gone to Harvard, spent 10 years of my life, and not learned everything I need to know? And I literally said, are you kidding me that it really comes? He goes, actually, it does. It just comes down to that. It comes down to not having that same level of excitement that you have in med school, where you find out a problem and you want to solve it. Like, hey man, I don't know about you out there listening, but I want a doctor who's totally effing geeking out on this stuff, right? Like, that's the doctor I want, right? I want the geek who's like, ooh, how do I, not the one that's like, whatever, I know what to do, you know?
Yes.
And so these guys are still in 30, 40-year-old. I mean, I have met doctors that have no idea what they're talking about. I in my book, I went to a doctor once, and he looked at me so confused when I told him when I described my situation. And he literally picked up his phone, and he said, Siri, what's the biologically active thyroid hormone? And I looked at him, and I go, how do you not know that? It's T3. You prescribe patients this. How do you not know that? I'll bet you $5 million right now. Of course, that's the answer. It was. This guy's prescribing thyroid hormones to people, and he doesn't even know what the biologically – and he didn't understand that. And he goes, well, wait a minute. That doesn't make sense. I'm like, dude, I'm trying to explain it to you. I'm drawing diagrams on a white sheet on the thing for a doctor.
That's scary.
Who's like, that's not – but here's the thing. I hope that sucker went and looked into it afterwards, okay? Because if he didn't, see, you know what I mean? And so – yeah, how is that possible? And he discounted me completely. He still went back to his old paradigm. Even after I explained it to him and everything, he was like, well, da-da-da. He was just quoting something out of a medical book. Does that make sense?
It makes too much sense. It's a nightmare. It sounds like it falls under that heading, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, things are changing now because, great, we have podcasts, we have, you know, internet, we have all of this free information to help people get on the right path. We have my book, we have, of course, but... you know, when I was going through this, like 13, 14 years ago, there wasn't even paleo. That wasn't even a thing.
Yeah, that's a relatively new thing here.
To look into there, and also a lot of the stuff wasn't known. And there was one other author who really saved my life, Paul Robinson. He wrote a book called Recovering with T3, and his book hadn't come out then either. So, you know, it just took really solving it myself. And I'll tell you what, it's a really scary place when you literally are like, are you kidding me? I can't find a doctor to help me. I've been to 50 doctors. Like, what? Like, that is just such a mind effery. Cause you're like, I'm in Los Angeles. I'm going to famous hormone doctors. I'm paying $600 for an appointment just to get a out 10 minutes. You know what I mean? And so it is really a crappy place to be, but what it taught me and what everyone should know is don't you dare accept any kind of diagnosis. First of all, get a couple opinions, of course, obvious. But the other thing too is you really are your own best doctor. It's not to say to take your health into your own hands like I did, okay? Don't be irresponsible. And I was very responsible about taking my health into my own hands and conservative about it. And I also, you know what? I was at my wit's end. I was like, these doctors are hurting me. I have no choice but to do this myself and dose myself with thyroid hormones back to health. So don't give up, and also realize that no one's going to solve your thing. If you got diagnosed with something, look into it, learn about it, get on it. You might not know more than your doctor you're currently with.
Whose disease is this? Is it men's or women's? Both equal? What's the story?
It's both, but it's not equal. So it is disproportionately a woman's disease. 1 out of 8 women will get it in their lifetime. But men do get it. They do get it, absolutely. And actually, they might be more likely to not have a doctor take a thyroid test because the doctor wouldn't think thyroid. But here's the thing. This is one way you know. There's a lot of guys that get into this game. They might have low testosterone, so the doctor's like, oh, okay, well, we'll just give you testosterone. At, like, whatever age, which, by the way, I've heard 20-year-olds being told that, which is not cool, and also older. But here's the thing. What's causing the low testosterone? You always have to go back to the master gland. Oh, this kid's acting bipolar. Oh, my kid's depressed. Really? Let's look at their free T3 levels. Let's look at their thyroid. It's that sometimes. So, you know, every psychiatrist should be testing thyroid and ruling it out right away for everything. It is the master gland. It is literally the master. There's, and by the way, if you're interested in health and fitness and just in general and fat burning, then you'll never get anywhere if you don't have good T3 levels. So everybody wants to support their thyroid. You know, whether it's working great now, keep it working. You got to learn about this. And if it's not working well, try to turn it around naturally. And if you can't, you go this way. Doesn't mean you can't go back and do it naturally at some point. But there's always thyroid hormones available for that. And it's not a drug. You know, it's not like a Lunesta or it's not like a it's giving you what you don't have. So it's when you're taking thyroid hormones, it's not. And not everyone needs to, but I'm just saying when you do that, it's not like, oh, it's a scary medication. It's like, no, it's not manipulating your body in a way that it shouldn't be. It's supporting it in the way that it should.
All right. I'm curious here. You said earlier that or implied something along the line of people being misdiagnosed with bipolar.
Yes.
And depression.
Yes.
What are Okay, that's. I don't even know how to. I don't even know how to. I don't know where to even go from there with that. What are some of the early?
I'll tell you.
Yeah, you're going to tell me so. But park that for a second, because I also want to throw into that. What is, not to create paranoia, but what are some of the early onset symptoms that people might have that they can, that if they suspect something's wrong, could clue them in early on that something's going on here, and how would they prevent from being misdiagnosed with the bipolar or depression?
Well, you would definitely need to get your thyroid tested comprehensively, and because I've told you now that they test wrong, you don't even know how many times people go, I go, oh, so did you get a thyroid test? They're like, yeah, it was fine. I'm like, really? Let me see the test. Wrong test. Okay, classic. All right. So just let's make sure everyone, if you do get a thyroid test, you get the comprehensive one. Here's what happens with the depression that sets in. It usually starts up pretty soft. And here's why it's kind of tricky to notice, because it can be full blown or it can be light. And the light part of it is, and by the way, once you solve hypothyroidism, then you're no longer depressed. But, you know, when you're hypothyroidism, you're have very low thyroid hormones. It starts off with like general malaise, kind of brain fog, not really being interested in things. So like, even if it's like you're not interested in a TV show, you don't want to read anymore. You have to reread the same paragraph over and over again. Just kind of feeling tired. Usually it does come with like physical exhaustion, but the brain stuff is kind of like giving up on dream stuff. It's kind of like you just don't have the mental wherewithal. And the way that hypothyroidism affects the adrenal glands, it makes a person sensitive to light, sounds, and smells, which then makes you extremely sensitive and overreactive to everything. Someone's perfume, and you're like, oh, you just can't deal with this. You just kind of like are a reactor. And so those are things, sensitive to light, sound, and smells, and literally not being able to access happiness. I mean, you know that when you're in it. But here's the silent, crazy thing about it is, if there's no other symptoms that are so obvious, or there might be some light ones, but you might think, oh, well, I haven't been working out and taking care of myself because I'm depressed, right? So if someone's starting to kind of like not take care of themselves or not care, that's another sign too. But essentially, it's scary because one could be thinking in their head. I had a friend who heard me talk about this, and she goes, oh, my God. And what it was brain for her. And she had this feeling on the inside like, well, my Aunt Mary, you know, my brother, right? Do you know what I mean? Like you might try to go down a road of explaining it away, or then you're kind of secretly keeping a secret of like, oh my God, am I aging quickly? Like I'm getting old. I'm getting dumber. It's the feeling of getting dumber. It's a weird thing, but if you hear it and you know it, you know it. You feel like you're getting dumber and older and you're aging in your brain. You can't remember numbers. There's people that quit their jobs who are accountants that can't remember any of that kind of stuff. So hand, brain dexterity, messy handwriting. I mean, there's some obvious stuff of brain stuff, but the brain, the depression part is usually, it can be just a general malaise where you're procrastinating forever. You just can't get things off the ground. And it usually is associated with, again, a general malaise. Like you can't really be happy. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. It's a terrible feeling.
It's a terrible thing. And I'll tell you, I was just interviewing someone the other day who is a fellow podcaster who actually is a girl who's on T3 only like I am, which is the last choice of thyroid hormone replacement. But just wanted to put that out there for people because I don't want anyone to hear it and go, oh, I'll just go get some. Because that's not how it works. If I were to give a depressed person or someone who has hypothyroidism, just like 5 micrograms of T3 twice a day for like 3 days, at the end of the second day, it would be like a light bulb went effing off in their brain, and all of a sudden they're like, is T3 a happy pill? That's literally what she said. She goes, oh my God. And you noticed your brain wake up because there's more T3 receptors in your brain, and T3 is the biologically active thyroid hormone. When you're hypothyroid, you have very low levels of free T3. Now, that's what doctors aren't testing. So we don't have to get into the details of all the tests.
That's a huge miss, though. That's a huge miss.
It's a huge miss. And so here's the thing. Erratic behavior in a teenager, right? And, you know, kind of bipolar-ish tendencies for anyone. Those could be mood swings that are generated not only based off, like, what's going on in the brain with the hypothyroidism. I mean, listen, I know someone's mother who's been mistreated with the wrong thyroid hormone, and she has Hashimoto's, which is an autoimmune form of thyroid disorder. And she was mistreated and totally misdiagnosed for 40 years. She has multiple personality disorder now. Now, I'm not saying it caused that, but I'm just saying her brain has suffered. Her antibodies were so high for 40 years. No one ever did a damn thing. She went all over the country, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars of her own money being like, why am I having these migraines? Now I've got this pain. Now I've got that pain. 40 years later, my friend gives me her results and I look at her Hashimoto's antibodies and both of them are like sky high through the roof. And I just started bawling crying because I'm like, this woman just wasted 40 years of her effing life. Got all of these things. Because here's the thing. Because it's the master gland, if it's not right, you will get a disease you otherwise would not have gotten if you weren't in a hypothyroid state. Does that make sense?
Total. Yep. Yep, absolutely. So you also have a diet that fixes or feeds or helps this. Tell us about it.
You know, it's a way of life. We don't like to say the paleo diet because it really isn't. It is a way of life, but it's an ancestral, evolutionary, paleo, primal. They're all really the same term. And it's about aligning our DNA as humans with what we eat. So for example, and I always use this one, but it's like no one's ever scrambled some eggs and fed it to a horse. Like nobody's done that. Nobody's cooked a ribeye and given it to a cow. You wouldn't do that because first of all, it's kind of mean. That's not how their DNA dictates a set of principles for them, right? Cows have four stomachs. Their DNA allows them to eat cellulose in the form of grass all day long. And we could not do that. Same with a horse, right? It's not meant to eat meat and it looks a different way, doesn't it? It doesn't look like us. So it's the same thing. This goes back to science. So if you get into the science of it, it's there. And the science is that grains, legumes, dairy, kind of not meant for human consumption. It's not to say that in the adaptable modern world, you can't have a piece of bread and brie. Doesn't mean you can't have full fat dairy occasionally. There's people in the paleo community that, you know, like some of the raw dairy stuff. There's some people in the paleo community that are strictly against it. We wouldn't have come across it regularly, ancestrally. But when we look at the history of humans, problems didn't start to happen and come on the archaeological record until about 10,000 years ago when we started to and domesticated animals and settled down and started farming. And that's when all the problems came on the scene. And that was 10,000 years ago. And then you have sugar showed up, or dairy showed up about, I think, not a little bit longer after that. And then sugar came after that. So, you know, all of the problems that are seen are usually from 12 or 10,000 years ago. And now our ancestors didn't have diabetes. They weren't overweight. No one was hypothyroid. And I could tell you that right now, not to say no one, but someone might have got a saber-toothed tiger slash through the thyroid and got screwed up. But like that could happen.
Bad day.
That was a bad day out there. But other than that, no one had those problems. Now here's the thing. So people always bring up the objection. They're like, all right, well, if cavemen were so healthy, why is the median, you know, average age lifespan 34 years old or whatever? And here's the thing, though. If you really look at the archaeological evidence, if you made it past puberty and you made it past that infection from the scrape on the poison oak tree, right? Because they didn't know what it was until someone got the scraped and then, like, Ulu died or whatever, right? Like, you know, so people made it into their 80s and 90s in good health. And you have to think about the people that died in childbirth, etc. You know, there was no, you know, emergency rooms. So if we really factor all that in there, the ones that really made it past puberty, you know, had a great shot and lived well into their 80s and 90s with no known health problems. And the reason I can say that they really weren't hypothyroid is population wouldn't have happened.
That makes perfect sense.
Just because if it was such a prevalent thing then, there wouldn't have been successful pregnancies, because that's one of the symptoms of hypothyroidism is, you know, and you could be hypothyroid and have a successful pregnancy, but still, more often than not, there's complications, or you could have a miscarriage. So it's really aligning our DNA. So now, doesn't mean you need to eat red meat. It's basically a high fat, moderate protein, low carb paradigm. This is all about getting intuitive and figuring out what's right for you. Sometimes people are like, I want to calculate macros. Da, da. You can do that at first, but that's not really what it's like. And the bottom line, though, is that sounds kind of gimmicky. But, oh, we align our DNA with. Here's the difference. The biggest distinction that needs to be made for anyone to understand this is this. What's so different about our ancestors, aside from just the food list, they were fat burners versus 99% of the world right now, or our country at least, which are sugar burners. How do you know the difference? If you're out there and you're listening, the way to know that you're a sugar burner is ask yourself a question. Could I just right now not eat for the next 8, 12, 24 hours without having a hangry mental meltdown, a physical something, a mood switch, brain hurting, most people would be like, no, I'd be going effing crazy. When you're fat adapted, the answer is, of course I can. And that is a freedom because you don't need to eat. You don't need it every 3 hours. You could take a 6 hour plane ride, get off in Hawaii, and then go drive an hour. You're totally fine. And let's look at that. Doesn't that make sense? Is it, we're the only living things that have to eat every, do you really think we're designed to have to eat every 2-3 hours? Doesn't matter if you believe in aliens, God, whatever, Big Bang, doesn't matter. What a cruel joke that would be. We'd be the only living things that have food addictions.
Well, here's the other thing, though. More and more studies. One came out just the other day. Another one pointing to the fact that the fewer calories you have, the longer likely you'll have a longer lifespan. So, if it isn't important enough to start eating right, start eating less too, and it all adds up to a healthier lifestyle.
Yeah, we're overfed, and we talk about that too. So when you get fat adapted, you end up getting calorically efficient, where you eat less food than you ever have before. And that's a really interesting train to go down. And then you get so fat adapted, and here's the thing. It's the ultimate in survival, literally, like as a hunter-gatherer. Because think about it. If you're a sugar burner, and you're having drops every 2-3 hours, and you're hypoglycemic like most people are, and you're on the sugar over carbohydrate dependency train, and look, every ad on television is for diabetes. We know it. We see it. You know, there's a reason for that, people. It's because people are carbohydrate dependent. And so you eat the carbs, you're up, they dissipate, they get burned. 4 hours later, you're down. Now, every time you eat that Pringle, you do wake up again. So now you've equated that with, but also when you're slumping out from heroin and you take some heroin, you also feel better too. You don't want to be a sugar burner. It's the ultimate in anti-aging, and it's the ultimate in just food addiction suffering. You eventually, you're just always thinking about food, and then it sucks. You can't eat like a huge meal or overeat if you want, and then not worry about having to go to the gym, and it's less working out. So I stress people to really look, go to Mark's Daily Apple or the Primal Blueprint and, you know, watch some free videos, you know, Google me and look at me talk about it more in depth, because people just think it's a food list, and that is just so base, man. It's not.
It's a lifestyle.
And there's more to it, like, because you can eat from a paleo food list and still not manage to get fat adapted and then not know and go, oh, it didn't work. And you're like, you didn't do it right. So and I've made every mistake in the book. So it's really a way of being, but it's really about, it's not a cult. It, you know, it's aligning yourself with really the ancestral principles, how to thrive with what we have. And also, everyone's got a genetic blueprint. We have choices of what we put on our body, receive from the outside in terms of mental stimulation and emotional stimulation, and also food, water, whatever it is, that can turn on or off these genetic switches. And frankly, you don't want some of these genetic switches turned on. So if you want to protect that system and have the good ones be upregulated and have the other ones just stay where they are, you know, this is a part of that.
You know, for you to write such a great book to be a number one bestseller, the Paleo Thyroid Solution, it's a phenomenal book. You really were first your own clinical study, and then you put it into this this beautiful book context and tell a personal story. That's different right there, but tell us what's really different about your book. What can people get out of that book that they're not going to get from what else is out there, and certainly what they're not going to get from their doctor that they will get from your book?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Because I didn't want to write a book that wasn't different, of course. And I really think it's the best one out there.
You're different. There's not a chance in the world that you wouldn't sit down, put pen to paper, and not come up with something different. But go ahead. What's up with that?
Oh, thank you. Well, no, you know, thank you. It's here's the thing. What you're going to see is you're going to see before and after blood work. Like, what is blood work? Like, you can tell me all you want about what tests to get. How do I look at this stuff, guys? How do I look at my own blood work and see what the hell's going on? So I've, like, here's what hypothyroidism blood work looks like. Here's what a normal person's blood work looks like. Here's what blood work looks like before and after they went on thyroid hormone. Here's where the consistencies are. And I also wanted to have success stories, people who were in there that did it, that got through it and looked good. You know, unfortunately, look, I'm not trying to be a bikini model. I'm not trying to be a shape model. That's not my game in life. But most people want to feel good. You know what I mean? They just want to feel good in their own body. And that's really the game here. It's just feeling good and healthy. Okay. So it's not about striving to be, you know, have an 8-pack. I mean, unless that's what you want. The thing that's different about this, though, is that a lot of the thyroid books, there's a lot of them. I don't see anything. It's like, I want to see someone that was fat and bloated and then wasn't. You know, yeah, that's what I want to see, because I'm hanging right now, and I want to have hope. So I wanted to give hope and show those pictures and one of my editors said to me at one point, I had kind of a TMI moment and a couple TMI moments in there in the book. And she said, oh, I don't know. Are you sure that's kind of TMI? And I go, no, it has to be, because it has to be that bad, because it was that bad. So people need to know that. And, you know, that's what resonates with people, because they need to know that it's that bad. Whatever, however bad it is for you, I get it. Do you know what I mean?
Yep,
I get
yep,
it.
Yep.
I was there. I was there, fully there. This is not like I solved this in a couple weeks and I think I'm an expert now. I suffered. I lost 6 years of my life. There's people that have lost 20.
You are, again, pushing down this interesting road here. I want to change tack for just a minute, and you're running low on time here, and we'll begin to wind up here with a couple of closing questions here. But you had a career in technology, and you also have a degree in philosophy. Okay.
Sounds funny when you say
it. No, I rest my case here. You know, Second City. Everything. I mean, everything there is to do with acting and comedy and all that. Philosophy, technology, paleo, thyroid, all that stuff. What's up with philosophy and technology? What did you do in technology, and why did you get a degree in philosophy?
You know, when I was looking, I was, you know, going to college, and I was looking through the big handbook of like all the different majors and the description of the courses, right? When you're picking stuff, you're looking through, and I was thinking, like, I wonder what my major is going to be. You know what I mean? Like, what am I going to major in? And I'm looking through, and I got to the philosophy section, and I started to read the description of the classes, and I was like, oh my God, you mean I can get a degree in talking about shit that I talk about with my friends at the beach when I'm getting high? Yeah, I'll get a degree in that.
That's great.
Literally, that was the, like, 18-year-old. But here's the thing, though. It's really not about, like, a drug story.
No, of course
not. It's about the fact that I was always interested in these topics, because I went to Catholic grade school and Jesuit high school. I was really interested in religious philosophy. I didn't understand. It didn't make sense to me that a rabbi and then a priest and a whatever could be sitting all next to each other. And I'm looking at them going, they all think they're right.
Yeah.
What's the answer here? So, you know, I'd always been a metaphysically interested person. And so when I read those descriptions, I was like, oh my God, because that's the stuff, right? Like, you know, you're 18, you're high at the beach, you're like, oh man, what does it all mean? Right. Okay. So of course that seemed right in line with it. And honestly, never looked back. I immediately was a major. It was my favorite thing in the whole world. And in my opinion, I think a degree in philosophy is the best degree you can have for business. I think actually it's a waste of time to get an undergraduate business degree, unless you want to get an MBA. I guess that could help you get into school. But
no, they're not worth anything either. I got one.
I think philosophy is incredible, because for a writer, for a communicator, and also in business, the problem-solving ability of being able to pan out the camera so far on any topic and then zero in, you know, and then also it's tons of writing. You're constantly writing. So it accidentally sort of makes you into someone who has to express and figure out a way to put really lofty thoughts and communicate them to someone else. And that's tough with philosophy. But I love it. And it's so funny because people would rip on it. And, you know, like there's Simpson, but everyone is rips on philosophy degrees all the time, right? Like, oh, what are you, basket weaving career with that? You know, like you hear the slams, you know, all over the world, like what a joke. I think it is one of the most valuable, in my opinion. So if anyone's interested in it and you're about to get like a BA, just get the BA, man. Just enjoy the 4 years, because it's a rite of passage at this point, not an uplifter into a career.
You know, my first degree is in music, but I can tell you that the most interesting class that I ever took in college, undergraduate, was philosophy of religion, because it didn't really have much to do with – it had everything to do with religion, of course, but I come from a different school of thought, and I took it because I had to have certain credits in that department. But it was so riveting. It was so interesting.
That's why everyone takes it, so you can imagine how boring it was for me as a philosophy major, because everyone in my class just wanted to be there to get the
credit. I love it. I took it for that reason, but it turned out being the best class I ever took, and it did make me think. And so it sounds like we're of the same school. If you're going to start a business, take philosophy, because it'll teach you how to think, and then start a business, because that'll teach you about business, not an MBA. So let me get two more things out of you, and we'll let you fly here, because you've got another interview to do. What's something – we've exposed a lot about you here today. Again, fascinating, diverse, interesting person. You've done a lot of different things, and I imagine it's just a whole – ball of fun working with you over there at Sisson's Camp. Share with us something about you that we don't know.
A lot?
Yeah, give me one big wow.
Oh, a wow. Oh, this is something that would be a wow, like something someone,
all right,
I don't
doesn't
know.
Have to be a wow. How about just one?
All right, here's random. I'll give a random one, then we can go from there. I can slalom water ski on a canoe paddle without a rudder.
Now that's I thought I was going to hear I could slalom ski as much. Well, I can do that, but you do it on a canoe paddle?
A single canoe paddle with no rudder.
All right, I'm not touching that. I'm going to come to the next. That's crazy. You're an insane. It's such a pleasure meeting you here. But what's next for you? What do we do next? You are always raising the bar for yourself. You can hear it in your energy, your passion. You are not static. You're always moving and moving and moving. So what's next for you? You have some unpursued passion around the corner or something that has to get done?
Well, you know, I'm going to speak at PaleoFX, which is a huge event in our industry this year, at the end of April. And I'm very happy to be a speaker there and then also on a panel. So I'll be talking about that and meeting all these people I've been podcasting with and for years and know through Mark, but have never met in person. So really excited to meet a lot of those other fellow authors. And then I have other books on the horizon. I have a television show I'm working on with a friend. That's a kids animated show that's pretty far into it. So always working in the entertainment side of things as much as I can. And then honestly, I want to write a philosophy book, but not a stiff philosophy book.
No,
like it's not going to be like,
possible.
It's not going to be like Socrates Revisited. Like I'm not going to do that. But I mean, a book about, a self-help book, I guess, self-empowerment, self-improvement. So that really is the next arena I want to get into, as far as writing, author-wise.
Right,
yeah.
Well, self-improvement is all about helping people. So let's wind up with this. You're a huge healer. You help people. You've done so much to bring people around and give them a new life. How can they reach out to you and find out more about what you do? The thyroid issue, paleo issues. What is the best avenue to get a hold of you so people can learn more about what you do and how you might be able to help them?
You can go to lruss.com, LLERUSS.com, and there's some videos up there and you can learn more about me and also get a free thyroid guide. Like if you don't even want to buy my book, but you need help. I mean, that's part of this thing is that, yes, we want to sell books, but at the other end, I spent so much money wasted. So I wanted to give away a ton of free information to get people on the right path. What blood tests do I get? What am I supposed to look out for? How do I take them? How do I find the right doctor? Put that all into like a little ebook guide so you can get that on my website. And then honestly, every Monday I do the Primal Blueprint podcast. I interview people on health and I also interview people on mind, body, life coaches and stuff like that. So anyone can go back. We have maybe 230 episodes or so now. You can go back to the first 14 and listen for free and find out what Paleo Primal is all about, you know, and then you can skip to the thyroid ones. And you know, so there's so much free information out there to get you on the right path if you need healing.
And they can get that, and they can get that all at lruss.com.
Yes, and also Primal Blueprint Podcast. The link to it's on my website, but also you can just find that on iTunes as well.
I'll put the link here below on the podcast here so people can click through and check it all out. Listen, you are amazing. Thanks so much, really, so much for taking the time today. You're full of life. You're full of energy. You're inspiring. You're uplifting, and you're doing so much to help people. And thank you for taking the time to spend with me and tell me about the stuff I learned a lot today. And I know the audience is going to learn a lot, too, and you're going to hear from some people. Thanks so much, Al, for taking the time to be with me.
Thank you so much for having me. You were great.
Pleasure was all mine. Al, we'll be in touch. Take care. Bye-bye.